Chapter 62. Magazine of arms and gunpowder that was there. In those times, every county had its own magazines of arms and powder, for its own trained bands or militia. So, the Parliament brought in a bill claiming the right which up to this time had belonged to the King, of appointing the Lord Lieutenants of counties, who commanded these trained bands, also, of having all the forts, castles, and garrisons in the kingdom, put into the hands of such governors as they, the Parliament, could confide in. It also passed a law depriving the bishops of their votes. The king gave his assent to that bill, but would not abandon the right of appointing the Lord Lieutenants, though he said he was willing to appoint such as might be suggested to him by the Parliament. When the Earl of Pembroke asked him whether he would not give way on that question for a time, he said, "By God, not for 1 hour." Apostrophe and upon this, he and the Parliament went to war. His young daughter was betrothed to the Prince of Orange. On pretense of taking her to the country of her future husband, the queen was already got safely away to Holland, there to pawn the crown jewels for money, to raise an army on the king's side. The Lord Admiral being sick, the House of Commons now named the Earl of Warwick, to hold his place for a year. The king named another gentleman. The House of Commons took its own way, and the Earl of Warwick became Lord Admiral without the king's consent. The Parliament sent orders down to Hull, to have that magazine removed to London. The king went down to Hull to take it himself. The citizens would not admit him into the town, and the governor would not admit him into the castle. The Parliament resolved that, whatever the two houses passed, and the king would not consent to, should be called an ordinance, and should be as much a law, as if he did consent to it. The king protested against this, and gave notice, that these ordinances were not to be obeyed. The king, attended by the majority of the House of Peers, and by many members of the House of Commons, established himself at York. The Chancellor went to him with the Great Seal, and the Parliament made a new Great Seal. The Queen sent over a ship full of arms and ammunition, and the King issued letters to borrow money at high interest. The Parliament raised 20 regiments of foot, and 75 troops of horse, and the people willingly aided them with their money, plate, jewelry, and trinkets, the married women even with their wedding rings. Every member of Parliament who could raise a troop, or a regiment in his own part of the country, dressed it according to his taste and in his own colors, and commanded it. Foremost among them all, Oliver Cromwell raised a troop of horse thoroughly in earnest, and thoroughly well armed, who were, perhaps, the best soldiers that ever were seen. In some of their proceedings, this famous Parliament passed the bounds of previous law and custom, yielded to and favored riotous assemblages of the people, and acted tyrannically in imprisoning some who differed from the popular leaders. But again, you are always to remember that the 12 years during which the king had had his own willful way had gone before, and that nothing could make the times what they might, could, would, or should have been, if those 12 years had never rolled away. Third part, I shall not try to relate the particulars of the great civil war between King Charles I and the Long Parliament, which lasted nearly 4 years, and a full account of which would fill many large books. It was a sad thing that Englishmen should once more be fighting against Englishmen on English ground, but it is some consolation to know that on both sides there was great humanity, forbearance, and honor. The soldiers of the Parliament were far more remarkable for these good qualities than the soldiers of the king, many of whom fought for mere pay without much caring for the cause, but those of the nobility and gentry who were on the king's side were so brave, and so faithful to him, that their conduct cannot but command our highest admiration. Among them were great numbers of Catholics, who took the royal side, because the queen was so strongly of their persuasion. The king might have distinguished some of these gallant spirits, if he had been as generous a spirit himself, by giving them the command of his army. Instead of that, however, true to his old high notions of royalty, he entrusted it to his two nephews, Prince Rupert and Prince Maurice, who were of royal blood, and came over from abroad to help him. It might have been better for him if they had stayed away, since Prince Rupert was an impetuous, hot-headed fellow, whose only idea was to dash into battle at all times and seasons, and lay about him. The general-in-chief of the parliamentary army was the Earl of Essex, a gentleman of honor and an excellent soldier. A little while before the war broke out, there had been some rioting at Westminster between certain officious law students and noisy soldiers, and the shopkeepers and their apprentices, and the general people in the streets. At that time the king's friends called the crowd roundheads, because the apprentices wore short hair. The crowd, in return, called their opponents cavaliers, meaning that they were a blustering set, who pretended to be very military. These two words now began to be used to distinguish the two sides in the civil war. The royalists also called the parliamentary men rebels and rogues, while the parliamentary men called them malignants, and spoke of themselves as the godly, the honest, and so forth. The war broke out at Portsmouth, where that double traitor Goring had again gone over to the king, and was besieged by the parliamentary troops. Upon this, the king proclaimed the Earl of Essex, and the officers serving under him, traitors, and called upon his loyal subjects to meet him in arms at Nottingham on the 25th of August. But his loyal subjects came about him in scanty numbers, and it was a windy, gloomy day, and the royal standard got blown down, and the whole affair was very melancholy. The chief engagements after this took place in the Vale of the Red Horse near Banbury, at Brentford, at Devizes, at Shalgrove Field, where Mr. Hampden was so sorely wounded, while fighting at the head of his men, that he died within a week, at Newbury, in which battle Lord Falkland, one of the best noblemen on the king's side, was killed, at Leicester, at Naseby, at Winchester, at Marston Moor near York, at Newcastle, and in many other parts of England and Scotland. These battles were attended with various successes. At one time, the king was victorious. At another time, the parliament. But almost all the great and busy towns were against the king, and when it was considered necessary to fortify London, all ranks of people, from laboring men and women, up to lords and ladies, worked hard together with heartiness and goodwill. The most distinguished leaders on the parliamentary side were Hampden, Sir Thomas Fairfax, and, above all, Oliver Cromwell, and his son-in-law Ireton. During the whole of this war, the people, to whom it was very expensive and irksome, and to whom it was made the more distressing by almost every family being divided, some of its members attaching themselves to one side, and some to the other, were over and over again most anxious for peace. So were some of the best men in each cause. Accordingly, treaties of peace were discussed between commissioners from the Parliament and the King. At York, at Oxford, where the king held a little parliament of his own, and at Uxbridge. But they came to nothing. In all these negotiations, and in all his difficulties, the king showed himself at his best. He was courageous, cool, self-possessed, and clever, but the old taint of his character was always in him, and he was never for one single moment to be trusted. Lord Clarendon, the historian, one of his highest admirers, supposes that he had unhappily promised the Queen never to make peace without her consent, and that this must often be taken as his excuse. He never kept his word from night to morning. He signed a cessation of hostilities with the blood-stained Irish rebels for a sum of money, and invited the Irish regiments over to help him against the Parliament. In the Battle of Naseby, his cabinet was seized, and was found to contain a correspondence with the Queen, in which he expressly told her that he had deceived the Parliament, a mongrel Parliament, He called it now, as an improvement on his old term of vipers in pretending to recognize it, and to treat with it, and from which it further appeared, that he had long been in secret treaty with the Duke of Lorraine for a foreign army of 10,000 men. Disappointed in this, he sent a most devoted friend of his, the Earl of Glamorgan, to Ireland, to conclude a secret treaty with the Catholic powers, to send him an Irish army of 10,000 men, in return for which he was to bestow great favors on the Catholic religion. And, when this treaty was discovered in the carriage of a fighting Irish archbishop who was killed in one of the many skirmishes of those days, he basely denied and deserted his attached friend, the Earl, on his being charged with high treason, and even worse than this had left blanks in the secret instructions he gave him with his own kingly hand, expressly that he might thus save himself. At last, on the 27th day of April, 1646, the king found himself in the city of Oxford, so surrounded by the parliamentary army who were closing in upon him on all sides, that he felt that, if he would escape, he must delay no longer. So, that night, having altered the cut of his hair and beard, he was dressed up as a servant, and put upon a horse with a cloak strapped behind him, and rode out of the town behind one of his own faithful followers, with a clergyman of that country who knew the road well, for a guide. He rode towards London as far as Harrow, and then altered his plans and resolved, it would seem, to go to the Scottish camp. The Scottish men had been invited over to help the parliamentary army, and had a large force then in England. The king was so desperately intriguing in everything he did, that it is doubtful what he exactly meant by this step. He took it, anyhow, and delivered himself up to the Earl of Leven, the Scottish general-in-chief, who treated him as an honorable prisoner. Negotiations between the Parliament on the one hand, and the Scottish authorities on the other, as to what should be done with him, lasted until the following February. Then, when the King had refused to the Parliament the concession of that old militia point for 20 years, and had refused to Scotland the recognition of its solemn league and covenant, Scotland got a handsome sum for its army and its help, and the King into the bargain. He was taken, by certain parliamentary commissioners appointed to receive him, to one of his own houses, called Holme House, near Althorp, in Northamptonshire. While the civil war was still in progress, John Pym died, and was buried with great honor in Westminster Abbey, not with greater honor than he deserved, for the liberties of Englishmen owe a mighty debt to Pym and Hampden. The war was but newly over when the Earl of Essex died, of an illness brought on by his having overheated himself in a stag hunt in Windsor Forest. He, too, was buried in Westminster Abbey, with great state. I wish it were not necessary to add that Archbishop Laud died upon the scaffold, when the war was not yet done. His trial lasted in all nearly a year, and, it being doubtful even then, whether the charges brought against him amounted to treason, the odious old contrivance of the worst kings was resorted to, and a bill of attainder was brought in against him. He was a violently prejudiced and mischievous person, had that strong ear-cropping and nose-splitting propensities, as you know, and had done a world of harm. But he died peaceably, and like a brave old man. Fourth part, when the Parliament had got the king into their hands, they became very anxious to get rid of their army, in which Oliver Cromwell had begun to acquire great power, not only because of his courage and high abilities, but because he professed to be very sincere in the Scottish sort of Puritan religion that was then exceedingly popular among the soldiers. They were as much opposed to the bishops as to the Pope himself, and the very privates, drummers, and trumpeters, had such an inconvenient habit of starting up and preaching long-winded discourses, that I would not have belonged to that army on any account. So, the Parliament, being far from sure, but that the army might begin to preach and fight against them now it had nothing else to do, proposed to disband the greater part of it, to send another part to serve in Ireland against the rebels, and to keep only a small force in England. But the army would not consent to be broken up, except upon its own conditions, and when the Parliament showed an intention of compelling it, it acted for itself in an unexpected manner. A certain cornet, of the name of Joyce, arrived at Holme House one night, attended by 400 horsemen, went into the king's room with his hat in one hand, and a pistol in the other, and told the king that he had come to take him away. The king was willing enough to go, and only stipulated that he should be publicly required to do so next morning. Next morning, accordingly, he appeared on the top of the steps of the house, and asked Comet Joyce before his men, and the guard set there by the Parliament, what authority he had for taking him away. To this Cornet Joyce replied, "The authority of the army." Apostrophe have you a written commission? Apostrophe apostrophe said the king. Joyce, pointing to his 400 men on horseback, replied, "That is my commission." Apostrophe well, apostrophe said the king, smiling, as if he were pleased, "I never before read such a commission, but it is written in fair and legible characters. This is a company of as handsome proper gentlemen as I have seen a long while." Apostrophe he was asked where he would like to live, and he said at Newmarket. So, to Newmarket he and Cornet Joyce, and the 400 horsemen rode, the king remarking, in the same smiling way, that he could ride as far at a spell as Cornet Joyce, or any man there. The king quite believed, I think, that the army were his friends. He said as much to Fairfax when that general, Oliver Cromwell, and Ireton, went to persuade him to return to the custody of the Parliament. He preferred to remain as he was, and resolved to remain as he was. And when the army moved nearer and nearer London, to frighten the Parliament into yielding to their demands, they took the king with them. It was a deplorable thing that England should be at the mercy of a great body of soldiers with arms in their hands, but the king certainly favored them at this important time of his life, as compared with the more lawful power that tried to control him. It must be added, however, that they treated him, as yet, more respectfully and kindly than the Parliament had done. They allowed him to be attended by his own servants, to be splendidly entertained at various houses, and to see his children at Cavesham House, near Reading for 2 days. Whereas, the Parliament had been rather hard with him, and had only allowed him to ride out and play at bowls. It is much to be believed that if the king could have been trusted, even at this time, he might have been saved. Even Oliver Cromwell expressly said that he did believe that no man could enjoy his possessions in peace unless the king had his rights. He was not unfriendly towards the king. He had been present when he received his children, and had been much affected by the pitiable nature of the scene. He saw the king often. He frequently walked and talked with him in the long galleries and pleasant gardens of the palace at Hampton Court, whither he was now removed, and in all this risked something of his influence with the army. But the king was in secret hopes of help from the Scottish people, and the moment he was encouraged to join them, he began to be cool to his new friends, the army, and to tell the officers that they could not possibly do without him. At the very time, too, when he was promising to make Cromwell and Ireton noblemen, if they would help him up to his old height, he was writing to the Queen that he meant to hang them. They both afterwards declared that they had been privately informed that such a letter would be found, on a certain evening, sewed up in a saddle which would be taken to the Blue Boar in Holborn, to be sent to Dover, and that they went there, disguised as common soldiers, and sat drinking in the inn yard until a man came with the saddle, which they ripped up with their knives, and there found the letter. I see little reason to doubt the story. It is certain that Oliver Cromwell told one of the king's most faithful followers that the king could not be trusted, and that he would not be answerable if anything amiss were to happen to him. Still, even after that, he kept a promise he had made to the king, by letting him know that there was a plot with a certain portion of the army to seize him. I believe that, in fact, he sincerely wanted the king to escape abroad, and so to be got rid of without more trouble or danger. That Oliver himself had work enough with the army is pretty plain, for some of the troops were so mutinous against him, and against those who acted with him at this time, that he found it necessary to have one man shot at the head of his regiment to overawe the rest. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.